Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another exciting edition of Monday Motivation. Hi everyone, this is Rabbi Garfinkel of Olami 613 Chicago with a live studio audience. Wow. Love that live studio audience. And yes, we have actually an incredibly meaningful podcast for you this week. This week, very, very special. There was an important rabbi, not just for me, but really for all of American Jewry and really Jewry worldwide, who died yesterday on Shabbos. And yes, recordings happen on Sunday here for Monday Motivation. In Jerusalem. His name is Rabbi Beryl Wein. He used to joke, he had a weekly news Torah update, Gilyon, they say in Hebrew. And he would call it the Wein Press, W-E-I-N. And he would always joke that he was a barrel of wine, and it was, you know, all the great rabbinic jokes. He was an incredibly special person and very influential in the best ways for the Jewish people. And I had a very powerful personal connection with him. So this week's Monday Motivation is going to be in his honor for the elevation of the soul of Rabbi Beryl Wein. May his memory be for a blessing, and may his influence continue to impact and to shape the Jewish future. Now, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to tell you a little bit about his life, and then where that intersected with me, the little one, my life. And then I'm going to tell over some of his stories. Because he was a lawyer, a historian, a kashrus organization head. He was the head of the Illinois Bar. He was the head of a yeshiva, the head of synagogues in America and in Israel. He had many, many hats. And he excelled at all of them. But there was one quality that, in my opinion, stood above the rest. He was a great storyteller. He was a great orator. And to this day, when I listen to him speak, I cannot figure out why. He spoke in an almost monotone voice, and I've confirmed this with several other people, that usually when you think of a captivating speaker, the voice rises and falls, and it has the right intonation at the right time. And he did have impeccable timing, but he almost spoke in a monotone. And I can't describe it. I don't know if others can describe it, but his talks were fascinating. People were spellbound, including me. And he was most famous, I think, for his history series. He went through the entire Jewish history series on tapes that obviously eventually made it to CDs and then obviously to digital. And so we're going to finish off the podcast with some of the stories that shaped him and that shaped me and that shaped the Jewish world. Okay, so let's begin. Rabbi Beryl Wein was a Chicagoan and he grew up. His father was a distinguished rabbi and was known as someone who was a tremendous scholar with a photographic memory. And the heads of the yeshiva would call him the bookshelf. He would be the one that would remember all of the Talmudic quotes and pages, etc. And nevertheless, but growing up in Chicago in the 30s and even the 40s, there was almost no one went to a Jewish school. And he went to public school. And when he came home, he said his mother would tell him what he can believe from the public school and what he can't. But on the pressing of his grandfather, who was a tremendous, tremendous Torah scholar, who was one of the founders of HTC, the Hebrew Theological College, which is still today thriving, called the Skokie Yeshiva, or the Yeshiva, he joined the yeshiva. Now, he was 11, and the youngest class was 16. So, nevertheless, he was able to keep up, and it says in an article I saw online, actually very interesting, that instead of him going to play basketball because he was so much smaller than the other guys, he would go to the library, and that's where his passion for Jewish history began. The library had 30,000 volumes of all sorts of books, and that's where his interest in history began. He then was, we'll talk about one story when he was a student there, but eventually went on, even though potentially wanted to go into the rabbinate, his mentors guided him that really being a rabbi is not so lucrative in that time, and it might not even be possible to find a position. And so even though he was accepted to University of Chicago Law School, which for a Jew in those days was incredibly difficult, but nevertheless, he turned that down. He went to DePaul Law School instead in order that he could continue his rabbinic ordination at the Skokie Yeshiva, which he did. He went on to practice law, which he admitted he did not like so much, sadly because his clients were mostly Jewish, and he said it's mostly Jews with money, and he says even Jews with money, even Jews with Torah values, money brings out the worst, and therefore he saw the worst sides of people in these conflicts, and sadly did not enjoy being a lawyer, but nevertheless ended up at a certain period being the head of the Illinois bar. This is the type of person he was. He was very down to earth, a straight shooter. People didn't, he would not give you the impression that he was a genius, but he was. He absolutely was. I sat in his Talmud class for a year, and it is absolutely clear what a genius he was. His good friend, Rabbi Rotman, a blessed memory, said that he was making aliyah and starting a yeshiva, and he wanted Rabbi Wein to take over his position as a head of a synagogue in Miami, which Rabbi Wein did, and eventually became an incredibly popular pulpit rabbi, building up the entire Miami Jewish community. Later on, he moved to Muncie, New York, where he established a school, Shari Torah, and a yeshiva as well, that he was the dean of for many, many years, up until 1997. But before we get to that, I will say that in the meantime, while he was the head, while he was in Miami and in Muncie, he worked for the OU. The OU was the main, and still probably the main, kashrus organization, making sure that foods that have products in them from China and Thailand and Zimbabwe and Australia somehow all come together into one food, and they all are kosher, which is really a remarkable, remarkable feat among many amazing facets of the industrial kashrus world. He was at the forefront of much of that. And there's going to be a story later about his position there. And eventually in 1997, at the age, I believe, of 63, if my math is correct, he started the last chapter of his life. The last chapter of his life that would last for 28 years. You know, pretty amazing. He died when he was 91 years old. And that was making aliyah. He came to Israel, and right away he started teaching at Or Sameach. And Or Sameach, I was there, and I remember it was the second year I was there, and we were in his Talmud class, and at that point I realized he was a genius. And he did his best to dumb it down for us, but I realized he was an absolute genius, and he pushed us very, very hard to understand the Talmud. And it was just incredible sitting in his class. Now, what I'll tell you is, it wasn't only that we were sitting in his class. His father, a blessed memory, came with him every day. He made aliyah with his father, and he took care of his father beautifully. And you saw that love and concern for his father. And so as much as there was the lessons about the Talmud, it was the fact that the Talmud had become so infused in him that he lived the lessons. The Talmud and Jewish ethical teachings weren't a theoretical construct. They, in fact, were the way that he interacted with people. And you could see it in the beautiful way that he interacted with his father. We had the benefit of having Rabbi Wein. Now, just to give you an idea, by the time I had gotten Dor Sameach, the entire year before, I was at Stanford University, and I was driving in my car all over between Palo Alto and San Francisco, where I taught Sunday school, in my parents' house in Marin County. And pretty much for an entire year, I was listening to Rabbi Wein's history series tapes again. So if you look them up, they're unbelievable. The Destiny Foundation, I recommend you look, listening and reading everything you can on that site. And so you can imagine, I literally had his voice in my ears for an entire year. And then coming to Yeshiva, spending my first year and the second year, then having the lecturer that I had listened to for so many hours sitting in his Talmud class, in his Gemara class, I felt that I was literally the rock star had entered, and I was with him. Of course, the Talmudic scholar is much better than the rock star, but you get the drift. And Rabbi Wein would take us on tours all over the country. The Beit HaTfutzot, which is now called Anu, it's the Museum of the Diaspora, and you walk through, it's on Tel Aviv University. It's a great, amazing, amazing place. Probably the best reason to go to Tel Aviv is this museum. And he would take us through and show us all the different stops, the Jewish people on 2,000 years of our exile had been traveling. And it was just absolutely fascinating. He kept the same mantra, boys, the Gullus is shutting down. The Gullus, the exile is shutting down. All these different places were shutting down, and he didn't necessarily see that as a bad thing. He saw the consolidation of the Jewish people in the major centers and then heading back to Israel as a very good thing. Okay, so now I want to share some of the stories that Rabbi Wein is famous for, that some of them he told us, some of them I read, some of them he heard, that I heard, but we'll start with one that when he was working for the OU, and it is really a remarkable, remarkable story, that in the 1973 oil embargo, when there literally was no oil to be had, there was an issue. Rabbi Wein received a call from Mead Johnson in Indianapolis, and it produced a children's vitamin, and the vitamin was suspended in glycerin, which is an oil derivative. So they could not get any oil, and they were sitting on 100,000 kosher labels. So basically what it would mean that it would have to stop production until they could print non-kosher labels or labels without the kosher certification, but they were not stopping it, and they had to have this oil. They could not stop 2 days of or 3 days of production until they could print new labels. They needed glycerin, and they needed it now. And it seemed almost they were ready to release this product to the world with these kosher labels on, which would have been a disaster because they didn't want to take the monetary loss. So Rabbi Wein put a call into Procter & Gamble, the only other company producing glycerin that was OU certified. Rabbi Wein says that he explained the problem to one of the vice presidents and asked him to supply Mead Johnson's needs at a fair price. So after mulling the request over, he had only one question for me. Will Rabbi Rosenberg in heaven know that I am helping? It is an unbelievable thing that he talked about the integrity, and Rabbi Rosenberg was the original founder of OU, and here is a non-Jewish head of a company was so impressed by this rabbi that he knew that he was in heaven, and he wanted to know that he could have charged much more than what he was going to charge. He could have upcharged it a lot, but he wanted to know. He had such respect for the rabbi that he wanted to help keep this kosher as much as possible. And Rabbi Wein always said that that is the way that Jews do our job in this world, that we're so honest and we're so good and we're so forthright that non-Jews will look at us and respect us because of our values, not because we hide from our values. And therefore, the disaster was averted. I want to go back to 1948. I had the privilege, and if you can go on the Or Sameach website, I am sure that this entire lecture was there. The year was 1998, and it was Yom Ha'atzma'ut, which is Israel Independence Day. And I remember we all crowded in at lunchtime, and Rabbi Wein, this was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. And Rabbi Wein talked about what it was like in 1948 to be a Jew in Chicago when the State of Israel was formed. And he told us that there was an old Chicago stadium, which doesn't exist anymore. And he said the entire Jewish community were packed into Chicago Stadium, thousands and thousands, where the Chicago team, I don't know if it was the Bulls in 1948, whatever the Chicago professional basketball team was called then. And then there were still people outside, thousands of people even outside. And they announced that the State of Israel was had been formed. They raised the flag. They sung HaTikvah. And he said the entire stadium started crying. They were crying, he said, for 10 minutes. He said most of the people in there were Holocaust survivors. Most of those people were only a few years away from Auschwitz, from Bergen-Belsen, from Mauthausen, from you fill in the blank. And they had come. Chicago had a tremendous amount of Holocaust survivors. And he said for 10 minutes, the entire stadium cried. And he said it was 2,000 years of exile in those tears were being let out. And the joy that a new page in our history had been turned. Wow, I still remember that vividly, exactly where I was sitting and the impact of that story. And I've heard him tell that story actually several times. I want to finish with one more story. And this story, boy oh boy, this is the story. So this story was from 1946, literally a couple of years before the story that I just mentioned of the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. And this was a monumental visit of the chief rabbi of Palestine, Rabbi Isaac Herzog, visited Chicago in 1946. The president of Israel today, President Herzog, this is his grandfather. Okay, a really unbelievable family story. So in 1946, he came to Chicago to raise money for the Vada Yeshivas, to make sure Jewish education in the land of Israel would be strong, as well as for the refugees who had made it to Palestine, to pre-state Israel. And so what happened? So Rabbi Wein was 12 years old at the time, and Rabbi Wein's father took Rabbi Wein along. There were hundreds of others who went to the airport to greet Rabbi Herzog on the tarmac. And it was, all the rabbis were there. It was really an incredible thing. They went and they greeted the rabbi as he deplaned. Now the rabbi came down and he was bedecked like an official chief rabbi. He had a top hat on, and he had a silver-handled rabbinic cane in one hand and a Tanakh, a Jewish Bible, in the other. This was like a real official chief rabbi. He gave a class in the yeshiva later, and then at the end of the class, okay, and get ready, fasten your seatbelts, because this is, maybe grab a tissue or two, because this story is just hits us between the eyes. He said, boys, I've just come from a meeting with the Pope in Rome. And the Pope at the time was Pope Pius XII. And the rabbi continues, he said, I presented him with the names of 10,000 Jewish children who had been hidden in monasteries and other church institutions by their desperate parents. I asked the Pope to return those children to the Jewish people. But he refused. He told me that once they entered a Catholic institution and had been baptized, that they were now Catholics and can never be returned. And despite the rabbis pleading and imploring, nothing. And so we see this pope was not so pious, or he was falsely pious. We call that kidnapping, by the way. So at that moment, Rabbi Wein relates that Rabbi Herzog put down his head on the shtender, on the lectern, and he sobbed. He cried, he poured his heart out, as Rabbi Wein describes, as I had never heard any adult sob before or since. It was the pain of 2,000 years of gullus of exile pouring out of him. And you imagine this scene of these young men seeing this great royal regal rabbi crying about these 10,000 Jewish children who've lost. And Rabbi Herzog then said, quote, I can't do anything more for those children. But what are you, and he pointed out to the young men in that room, but what are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? What are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? And Rabbi Wein relates that they went in line to shake his hand, and he asked each boy, he says, did you hear what I said? What are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? Remember what I said? And Rabbi Wein would always say that he still remembers those words ringing in his ears. And he went on, he would always talk about all the different rabbis, famous rabbis, who were there with him, who heard the call, and who changed the Jewish people. Rabbi Dr. Avraham Twersky, I had no idea that he was there. Rabbi Yehuda Cooperman, the founder of Michala. All these, Rabbi Rotman, who we mentioned earlier, founded Yeshiva and then in Israel. So many more, Rabbi Fassman, and I did not know this as well, Rabbi Naftali Kaplan, who was one of my other rabbis who had a big influence on me. And he would tell us, and he would look out to us, and he said, would say, boys, what are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? What are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? And those words stuck with me. You know, being in Jewish outreach, if I may be honest, it's a tough, tough field. We're literally sweeping the ocean back with a broom. The tidal wave of assimilation of Jews who don't know, to no fault of their own, about how amazing it is to be Jewish. And there's a lot of rejection, and there's a lot of no's. And there are times where you feel like, let's go, come on, guys, we got this. We can't just marry out, we can't, come learn, do. And those moments of darkness, of times of a little bit of despair, I remember this story. What are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? Garfinkel. What are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? So I'll finish this podcast in memory of Rabbi Beryl Wein by asking you, the listener, what are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? What are you going to do to rebuild the Jewish people? God bless. Have an amazing week. And we will see you right back here next week, God willing, for another exciting edition of Monday Motivation.